If you see something, say something. At Reply, weird things come with any weird story you find on the web, and you can help make weirdthings.com even weirder.
Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com. Hey, buddy. Justin here. My buddy, I mean everybody listening, because you're all my friends. You know who else is my friend? Tom Merritt. You might know him from Tech News Today, Sword and Laser, but he also does a podcast called FSL Tonight. With who? Me. That's who. It's a fictitious sports league comprised of all sorts of science fiction and fantasy characters. Now, that might seem a little confusing, but the good news is there's a video where we explain it. You can go on over to Kickstarter.com and just search FSL Tonight, and you'll come up to a page where we explain everything about the league. Oh, also it's on Kickstarter because we're having a Kickstarter. Our third season is going to be completely ad-free, and we got some really sweet perks if you are interested in this concept or already listen to the podcast. So head on over to Kickstarter, search for FSL Tonight, and back it if you want. If you don't, no sweat. Seriously, it's not a problem. Don't worry about it. It's very niche, you know. I mean, I'm not begging you for money here. Seriously, I am kind of, though. Please, give me money.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends.
And Mr. Brian Brushwood.
I got to out him. The fact that just before we went live, you called him Turkish Reed Richards, which I'm very much a fan of.
I think it's a fairly legitimate claim.
He's Mr. The Fabulous.
Yes. I was the diversity hire on the Fantastic Four.
Like, we're going to fill the quota. Quota for what? I don't know. Look at him.
What's diversity in like Turkey though? Would that be like he's a gypsy?
Yeah, maybe I can't remember the name of the Christian population in the Middle East, but
he's like Reformed Orthodox or something.
Sure. I'm Russian Orthodox.
There you
Russian
go.
Orthodox.
So, gentlemen, we've got kind of an interesting episode here, some fun, varied topics to talk about. And right off the top of the bat, I want you two to imagine your explorers exploring. And speaking of Turkey, we're in Turkey.
Okay? Hey, look at that.
We're exploring in Turkey, and we're going through some ruins, and we come across, I don't know, maybe something that looked like it was carved a long time ago, maybe some stonework. There was some sort of monument or site here, and beyond it is a deep cave.
You say we got carvings? Like intentional, like scripts written there?
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to like Greek times or something.
Ah, so it looks like you know, like you got like a delta, maybe an epsilon, an alpha here?
Yeah.
All right.
Those things.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, you're in front of us. What do you want to do?
Do any of us speak Greek or read Greek? That might be helpful.
Yeah,
in this
not enough to really read. You know, you can tell that like there was some sort of monument here, and beyond that, there's a cave.
But the monument. So let me take a look at this monument. I mean, is it super impressive, or it looks more like maybe it was a little mausoleum back in the day?
Yeah, it's kind of falling. It's kind of crappy now.
Doesn't matter. All you can tell is there used to be a marker of some variety.
You're like, this may have been like a, you know, an Iro hut or something at one point. You know, it's not, you know, like you're an archaeologist. Like you can pick up a little pottery shard and go, oh, my God, that's amazing. We'd be like, it's clay, dude.
Now, when you say cave, are we talking like just to crack? Like, can we walk in or do we have to crawl in? Because that's going to affect my excitement.
You can walk in.
Do we have flashlights?
Yeah, all right. How different does it look? From the place in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade?
You don't see like things in the floor that are look like if you step on them, spears are going to come at your face.
But there's like dimension-wise, size-wise, like the ceilings are about as high. Like, is that a good frame of reference?
Now you said Last Crusade. You meant Raiders of the Lost Ark, right?
No, I mean Last Crusade when they go into the
the one with the sewers or at the end?
No, like at the end with only the penitent man will pass.
See, I was thinking more like the one at the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Well, he was talking about carvings and stuff like that, you know, like a regal but forgotten area.
Yeah, but none.
Okay, so let me give you a little bit of the landscape here, okay? Using some computer reconstruction and stuff. Electronics are probably involved.
Probably.
Maybe software. You could tell there was like a pool, like a small kind of like wading pool near there. There was a roundish sort of temple there. And then there was this entrance, this portal to the caves. All right? So you're standing there. Now you have the portal to the entrance. Now, what do you want to do?
Well, let's go in, right? We got flashlights. We got like maybe mosquito nets over our heads. Maybe we got some bat mace to spray. Okay. What else you need?
So you guys are walking into the caves. You're walking into the caves. And, Bri?
Yeah?
When you wake up in a cold sweat in the middle of the night and Bonnie has to cradle you,
mm-hmm.
What is the image that makes this happen to you?
Other magicians.
Okay. Other magicians are in this cave.
No, please say they're not. And they're all criticizing me for what I do on Scam School?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh no! This is highly uncomfortable. I'm not okay being here, Justin. I got to get out of here.
Justin, physical manifestation of the Magic Cafe.
It's the actual Magic Cafe. I need to like pull out my kryptonite. I need to pull out like a fifth of whiskey and just start drinking immediately.
So Justin, when you wake up in the cold sweat in the middle of the night. By the way, I've heard two stories this week about people who were on airline trips from Vegas or in and around traveling places, and the assumption was that they were having some sort of medical injury or medical illness.
Yeah.
One was Seth Rogen and his Angry Whopper marijuana brownie story.
And the other was you
and your shrimp cocktail.
Yeah, no, I had a bit of an angry shrimp cocktail that, I'll tell you what, let's just say it didn't want to leave Vegas and made every attempt to make sure that it did. It didn't. What keeps me up at night? I don't know. I guess like I'll probably the stuff that.
Uh-oh. He's taking a moment to think.
If anything,
about it.
Is more the garden variety, like falling toward death, like that kind of stuff.
Okay, so you walk in there and you fall towards your death.
No. And the whole time he's falling, the magicians are criticizing how he's falling.
Yes.
They're like, I wouldn't fall that way. That's not how. Let me show you my handling of the falling to the death.
You see, gentlemen, I admire your explorer spirit, but whenever you go to an archaeological site. One, it's important to understand, you know, the name. And so this location is called Pluto's Gate, right?
Nothing wrong with that.
Okay, well.
Ain't even a planet no more.
Who was Pluto?
He was that lovable dog companion. He was the loser of the two brothers. Like, for some reason, Goofy was bestowed with the ability to speak and intelligence. But, like, Pluto is the dimwit half brother
relegated to servitude.
Yes, exactly. Which it's under like the to be honest, I'm not okay with I'm not okay with Pluto. I'll go on the record. I'm not okay with Pluto's treatment in the Disney canon. I feel like a second class citizen that Pluto.
Well, I don't think we ever made the distinction if Goofy was like supposed to be a dog or a cow or whatever.
Well, they say it. They say it. And in fact, they say it in because this is what I wondered all my childhood until Who Framed Roger Rabbit. When they get to the end and they're like, you don't have to be a duck. And he's like, or a mouse. And then Goofy says, or a dog. That's how I knew.
All right.
And then so, mysteries.
Here's
resolved.
My question.
Okay.
Who was Pluto?
The bitter.
Wait, this was Pluto's cave?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was Plato's retreat.
No.
Isn't it like we're
that
a couple.
Just as horrifying.
We're a couple on spring break and he's holding up the brochure. He's like, well, look at it. It looks like it says Plato's retreat.
See, Plato would imply some sort of maybe hedonistic.
Sure.
Where Pluto, we were down god here of the underworld.
Turkish desert.
So Pluto, when you go to Pluto's gate.
Oh, he is god of the underworld.
What is the gate holding back?
Hell? Demons?
Why would you call this cave hell?
Because it's wait, Pluto's like god of the underworld, right? And then and Pluto's gate, so it's like the literal gates of hell, right?
Yeah. How do you get that name?
You're hot.
Like that was like, you know, it was like Pluto's like joke where it's like, yeah, come on and check out Pluto's gate. You know.
Gateway.
So we have this account of one of the first people to discover this cave.
Yeah.
This comes from a Greek geographer by the name of Strabo in about 64 BC or 63 BC. We're not quite sure.
Record keeping, not quite about, what it could have been back then.
That was when he was born, and then he died around 24 AD. He writes, this space is full of a vapor so misty and dense that one can scarcely see the ground. Any animal that passes inside meets instant death.
Holy cow. So there's some kind of like radon leak times a billion where it's like it's creepy green mist coming out of the ground.
Yeah, probably not radon, but a bad gas. I mean, probably radon there too, but like, yeah, just really, really bad noxious gas. If you sleep near it, as the eunuchs did back then, you know, good work if you can get it.
Yeah.
You know, so he so when Strabo wanted to test it, I threw in sparrows and they immediately breathed their last and fell.
Hey, okay, who is this genius scientist whose like sole experiment is throwing living things into the gates of hell and watching them die?
Strabo.
Strabo. That sounds like.
I like to imagine Strabo is like a proto Johnny Knoxville type. Like, hey, Strabo. This is Strabo, and this is throwing a dove into the Pluto's gate.
And then he's getting ready to do it. And then, like, there's another Greek dude who's, like, mocking him in Greek. And then, like, his name pops up. It's Weibo to the side. Like, Weibo and Strabo just throwing stuff in.
So they had a ceremony where they'd lead animals to the cave and then drag them out dead. The eunuchs would try not to breathe. And they'd lead the animal inside there, like, bulls. And then it would collapse from the fumes. And then they'd pull it back out.
So how many things do you put? I guess... I wanted to make a joke about how many animals you got to throw in before you figure out, yeah, it's bad gas. But I guess that you start with like a bird, something that's highly sensitive. And then when that dies, you're like, okay, well, that makes sense. And you throw like increasingly large, tougher animals. Like, what's the biggest animal you think they put in there?
Well, they had a bull.
That's a pretty big animal. And the bull died?
No, bull went to sleep.
And then they pull it out and it lived?
No, Brian, it's not the way death works.
Well, Justin said, I'm sitting here, I'm like a child who wants to believe. I'm like, so he's just taking a nap, right, Justin?
Very long, a dirt nap, Ryan.
A little sleep forever.
You got to think about this. So here, you know, somebody found this cave, this death cave, and it was, you know, maybe it was called Death Cave before. And there are a lot of gates to hell. That's the thing I love is I've been reading stuff about caves in Europe and like there's one like Switzerland and up and nobody explored these caves up until like 100 years ago. And a lot of these caves, they'd be like, oh, yeah, that's the gate to hell. And so you'd have a village living below this cave. What's that up there? Oh, the gate to hell. Anyways, if you try the cheese, it's really, really good.
You know what? Here's the thing is, and it's getting increasingly hard. Like, we all remember a time before the internet. Maybe not Justin, but certainly you and me. Like remember a time before the internet when there just was no way to counterbalance the rumors and myths you would hear about stuff. And then, like, imagine living next to one of these and your father and your grandfather, and everyone says, oh, no, that's the gate to hell. Anything that goes in dies because that's where the devil lives. And there's zero evidence to is it countermand? Is that, am I using that word right?
Works for me.
Wait, sure. There's nothing that you can, it's just the freaking gates to hell and the devil's real in there.
And if, in this case, if you actually like, no, you guys are idiots. I've got science. I'm going to prove you wrong. You go inside and you die. And they're like, yeah, we told them. So imagine you figure out like this gate to hell. You're like, yeah, it smells funky there. Like, all right, there's a vapor. There's something. And you're like, it's on your property. And you're like, you know, the neighbor kids come over and they play in there and they die. And people kind of complain. And they're like, you got to seal it up. And you're thinking, you know, maybe there's a business opportunity here.
Oh, like a fun park, like visit the gates of hell. And then maybe you have like medals for how many steps, like you get a few eunuchs to paint lines closer, like yard lines. Like it's a, if you could play hell football, right? You throw a pass if you received it.
Brian, you are thinking way too small on this because you're thinking death theme park.
Yeah.
Right. But ultimately, like, how long are you going to have just people murdering themselves? The suicidal are not a, that's not a bankable demographic for the amusement park industry. If these are gases that, you know, give you visions on some level, what you do is you just secure all the area around the gates, take a couple big fans, big area fans, fan that gas on out there, and you're going to have the next home of Burning Man in no time.
That's pretty
Everyone's
brilliant.
Everyone's going to be out there in devil horns and a jock strap having a great time.
And just like with Burning Man, you know, they got that whole, like, different orbits. It's all circular. You got different orbits going farther out. You know, like you got the looky-loo tourists out of the farthest orbits, and then a little while in, you got, you know, giant hippies with the dreadlocks and all the artsy types, and then, like, in all the way at the front is just Gary Busey and a few other folks heading at the 10-yard line. I'm still going to have yard lines.
Dead animals.
And then, yeah, maybe that's the thing, is you slowly lead your animals closer and closer to the center, and then boom, they drop dead at the end, and everybody high fives because they're so wasted.
I just like to take it as just an example of, you know, you could see, like, somebody bought the property and they're like, oh man, we got a gate to hell that kills everything that comes near. This sucks. And then somebody's like, oh no, this is awesome. What do you mean? We can build a temple here.
Yeah.
And we'll get a bunch of guys with chopped nuts to go hang out and have hallucinations
now, what
there,
is it?
Eat animals in there.
Man, that sucks. It's like, it's bad enough that you got your nuts cut and you're a eunuch. But then on top of that, it's like, hold your breath and run in there, bro.
Yeah.
Come on, get that cow, pull it out.
But you want to know what? I mean, like, the definitions of life have to be rewritten on some level, right? Like, you know, once you get your nuts chopped off, it's like, you know, whatever. Like, let's just roll the dice. I'm a eunuch.
Yeah, priorities are different at that point.
I don't know. I mean, if you ask me, some eunuchs are just obsessed with protecting the realm. That's all they want to do.
I'll tell you what. Really misunderstood.
Some of those eunuchs.
I just like the idea that it's... You're signing up for the job, and it's like, you know, you don't read all the lines of the application, you know?
Or it's like you don't know what eunuch means. It's just be a eunuch, and it lists all the benefits.
And you see, but and you're lining up for what you think is a physical, and they're like, all right, turn your head and cough. All right, yeah, whatever. While you're down there, oh, my God!
Like, what did you do?
What the hell are you doing?
With that back. And he's like, no backsies, bro. And then he just drops.
our friend, me and Andrew have a friend, Rachel, who has a traumatic story of she grew her hair when she was very young. And then she went to go get a haircut, and they just, like, completely cut off, like, the entire ponytail and just handed it to her. And, like, the traumatic moment was the barber lady or hairdresser handing her ponytail that she had grown for years and just saying, do you want to keep it?
Oh, my God.
So that's what I imagine to be this scenario with the eunuch. Just all of a sudden, you're in tremendous pain, and then it's, do you want to keep it?
So that's the question, of course, is do you? I mean, like, do you want this constant reminder of what you no longer have staring you in the face from a pickle jar?
Well, I just want to back up for a second. Let's go back just to the right before, because, you know, you go in there, you think, you know, they're going to do the cough check. You've got your lines, your jokes you're about to make about, right. Oh, your hands are cold. You need to buy me dinner. So your brain is just filled with all the little witty one-liners you're going to say, because you have no idea what's really about to happen. And then they grab and they're like, hey, baby, buy me. Oh, my God. And
but then it's like,
you want to keep it.
You're just so panicked that you don't, like, your brain doesn't have any other routines ready to run. So you just go ahead. You're like, are you going to buy me dinner first? You say to the guy who's holding your testicles in front of your face.
So now we're in your situation where they're holding them going, do you want to keep them?
I mean, yeah, I guess.
You're like, yeah. You're like, sure. Do they go back?
I guess. Yeah. You can always throw them away later. You could always, like, 3 weeks from now, when you finally come to terms, have this big symbolic chucking your balls off a cliff moment where you're like, I don't need you anymore. No, I'm going to Pluto's gates. Yeah, I don't need you anymore.
I was like, you guys are, like, waiting outside. I come walking out. Hey, how'd it go? I'm like, oh, you guys, all walnuts, great.
Oh,
I'll tell you, I'd like to have them dipped in gold and jeweled so I could hang them from my necklace like a wrapper.
Dude, That's actually not bad. Or better yet, you can Fleetwood Mac style tie them like little bolo ties around your waist, like have them dangle right where they're supposed to be.
Sure.
D's nuts? D's nuts. For our audio listeners, I pretended to be holding testicles in towards the webcam.
Oh.
It's one of these, like, eunuch. It's like, man, had to be a different time. I just can't see that brochure being very persuasive today.
I just love the fact that out of this whole story, yes, the gates of hell, the physical embodiment of an entryway to the underworld. But seriously, those slaves, like, they didn't have any testicles.
No, that's none. None at all. Not even like they were guarding a harem, you know?
Hey, do we still have our same sponsors?
We certainly do. We are continuing to be sponsored by Area 1851. This is a Kickstarter for an amazing game. It's a tabletop game. Tabletop Day just happened last week. But you want to know what, folks? Keep the party going. Make sure that this thing happens. We got a long ways to go, man. He is at about $3,000. He needs $25,000 to make this thing happen. And this is Kickstarter, so it's all or nothing. But go ahead on over to area1851.com. Watch the video. Check out what you're going to get if and when you go ahead and donate. And,
dude, this is that game theory moment where it's like, you got no reason not to donate to this because we want it to happen. We want to go all the way. It's a really cool idea. The card game aspect of it really intrigues me. And you can play that game. It's like you only get charged if he hits his, if it's going to happen. It's either going to happen and you're going to get to play this thing or it's not going to hit his numbers. You win either way. I mean, not that you win if it doesn't happen, but I mean, you have nothing to lose is what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely. So go ahead and check it out, man. It is awesome. Area1851.com and go ahead and follow at five, 2-4 labs on Twitter. That is 524 with 5 spelled out and 24 in numbers labs on Twitter. And hit them up if you have any questions about it. It's going to be a pretty swinging time.
Yeah, we should remind people, like, the whole idea is it's you make outrageous contraptions using all of these pieces. They have card elements. For it. It's got kind of a weird steampunk Western feel to it. So you combine different alien artifacts and common objects to create. I mean, it looks like a lot of fun.
There we go. That is area1851.com. And, you know, only 11 days on this Kickstarter. So everybody go make a show.
Yeah, jump two.
Gentlemen. We've heard of big science before.
Yeah.
Sure.
Big buzzword right now is big data. We've talked about ambitious experiments, and sometimes to do really groundbreaking research, you either need to get a ton of money or maybe you need to break some rules. When you start looking at some of the things we know about, let's say, human endurance, okay? Two of the principal areas we've learned, three things. You learn things, one, by just accidents happening.
Right.
We learn stuff from horrific Nazi experiments, which some of the research we question because the Nazis actually weren't that good of scientists. Sure. You know, the really good ones kind of left. There's some interesting naval experiments. The Navy's like, hey, we're the Navy. We put people under water. We got to find out. How long can you go without breathing? Oh, killed another one. All right. I mean, they didn't get that bad, but. You know, one of the experiments, one of the reasons we know about how long somebody could survive in space came from an accident at NASA where they were testing. You know, they have that big, huge chamber, the big, huge vacuum chamber they evacuate all the air from because they do the vacuum chamber. They had an astronaut in there with a pressure suit, and he got a rupture in it. And so he went through rapid depressurization and got to experience firsthand what happens. He survived. But
how long was it?
I'd have to look that up. I remember it was longer than you'd want to.
You mentioned something about space and how long people can survive underwater. I don't want to sidetrack your story, but I just realized that I had the most amazing story I've ever been told by a bartender server in my entire life. happened last month when I was with my friends at this conference in Nashville. Would you have that? You want me to cut? You want me to tell this? I'll tell you the short version while you're looking that up.
Yeah.
I'm wearing a hat that happens to have a plane on it, and the guy comes over. You know, he's joking. He looks to be a guy maybe in his like 50s or so, and he makes some joke about like, oh, well, this guy's airplane. We don't like airplanes. Submarines do it deeper. And I was like, oh, submarines. You were a submariner. I was like, is it submariner or submariner? He's like, yeah, it's submariner. And I was like, what's the deepest you've ever dove? And he's like, you mean in a submarine or scuba diving? And I was like, both. And he's like, in a sub 25, 50 feet. And he says, in a suit, 2,800 feet. And that's exactly what I did. I just looked, I was like, wait, how what does that mean? And he goes on to say, he's like, well, you know, I joined the Army or the Navy when I was 18. And, you know, I was volunteered for a lot of stupid stuff. And we were doing such and such down in the Antarctic near the bottom of South America, basically. And whatever that thing is, basically that crap from the abyss, that breathing super oxygenated water, it's a real deal, bro. It's a real thing. And he volunteered and did it. Casually mentions that he died twice. He said the process was that you don't actually breathe. There's no respirating. There's no in and out. So they have to disable your diaphragm. So they knock you out. They inject this giant needle. They ruin your diaphragm with the numbing thing so that you don't actually breathe. They fill your lungs with this super oxygenated liquid, and there's no like feeling like you need to breathe, because the only reason you feel like you need to breathe is you've got lung full of carbon dioxide, which is what something about the lactic acid or so. You build up some acid, which is that's what you feel the need to breathe is when you have too much CO2. But because you got none of the water in there, he says he died twice during the times that they did this, and then went on to tell us the single most harrowing story of a series of malfunctions in his submarine that I could not possibly do justice, but it was it involved the sub dipping well below its crush depth and tilting backwards so that the entire engine room, the nuclear engine room, was underwater, and the person whose job was to flip the emergency blowers, they were too low to hit the emergency blowers without exploding, basically, and it continued to slip down. They got just enough engine power they had just enough electricity to get up to like within 100 feet of safe depth, and this guy who was telling the story. The captain says, you know, hit the blower, and he didn't, you know, he just hit the switch he could reach, not realizing the protocol was you always hit the front blower first and then the rear. But he was just like, hit the blower. So he just hit the one he could reach. And the rear one, the deeper of the two, the one that risked bigger explosions, like, not only is there this moment of like, we're below the safe depth and it's my job. The captain just gave an order. I'm going to flip this switch, and this could be the moment that I press a button and we all die. So he hits it. The back part goes off first, which worked out great because it lifted the back part to even everything out. The water comes rushing forward and evens out. He hits the other one, and then they rise up. And the captain says, hey, how did you know to hit the back one first? Because protocols, you hit the front ones first. And he was like, that was just the one I could reach. And the captain was just like, oh, no, that can't be the story, because if that's the story, then we're all in a world of crap here. So the official story became that the whatever rank he was, the seaman knew that it was the right thing to do in order to get the backside up and get them up. And he ended up getting a commendation for it. Like, he got a medal for his quick thinking, because the official story had to be that he did it on purpose.
That he was awesome. That he's Mr. Awesome Pants.
It was amazing, dude. That guy was the real deal. Or at least he was the real deal at telling an awesome story. I don't care if it was
spun
true
a real
or not.
Yarn.
Yeah. So how long did that guy live for? Were you able to find
it? In this instance, the guy lost consciousness for about 15 seconds. The pressure was restored after about 30 seconds of exposure. He regained consciousness with no apparent injury. Mm-hmm. And there's different accounts of people in different situations where sometimes, like, you know, the air pressure goes out, they can't breathe, there's no breathe response. They put air back in, then they start to gasp.
Wow.
So, but I'm going to talk about a different kind of research on the edge of what could be ethical.
Okay.
So, a gentleman, we'll call him the anonymous hacker.
Okay.
Because that's all we know about him.
All right.
Was curious. He wanted to know how many vulnerabilities were there in IPv4 addresses, which are lesser secure than like the IPv6 or whatever the next generation thing we want to do. Some technical thing I don't really understand. He wanted to know, you know, like how many machines, how vulnerable were computer networks out there? What was a vulnerability out there? He wanted to get an idea, like the largest sample he possibly could to do that. And so we figured, you know what? Why don't I design myself a little piece of software and create my own little botnet on open machines and have them go out there and go see how many vulnerabilities I can find. And he did this experiment. He actually was able to take over 420,000 devices.
Good Lord.
Okay. Now, I mean, of course, this is when anonymous researchers saying this, we have to put an asterisk there. It could be BS, but everything's plausible because we know there are things called botnets. We do know that computers get spammed all the time. So everything's plausible. It said he took over 420,000 internet-connected devices and through a nine-month project found 420 million IPv4 addresses that responded to probes and 36 million more that had one or more ports open, meaning he found, you know, that many open devices. He found millions and millions. What do we got here?
This is the map. This is the map of where the vulnerability is. And you can see that there's even a few, you know, out at sea IP addresses indicating where geographically they are over the...
Okay. Now, here's the funny thing. When I first saw that map in the article, I thought, yes, but what is a map of just internet usage?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, apparently it tracks one for one. Wherever there's internet, there are exposed vulnerabilities in IPv4. This says Karna botnets, 420,000 client distribution, March to December 2012.
So this brings us to the question, and I'm glad you're familiar with this because I want to you know, bring up this sort of topic here. And ethically, the only person who can really say, you know, I mean, everybody's going to have their own opinion if it's ethical or not. And if he did no harm to the machines that he used.
Well, he also intentionally, I believe, he said, I intentionally wrote the routines to take up as little of their processing power as possible. You know, he wanted to be courteous and you just sort of piggyback so it doesn't, you know, no noticeable loss of capability to anyone whose router was hacked. Yes.
Now we only have his word for that. I'm not going to get into, you know, I would say that statistically speaking, these machines were just as likely or more likely to become vulnerable to things that were going to be less benign than what this guy did.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it brings up that idea though of you know, Batman breaks some rules, you know. You know, when the Punisher's sitting on top of a rooftop with his missile launcher ready to take out the drug dealers, he's trespassing.
That's
not to mention probably committing some arms violations.
Also, I would imagine he probably is violating a few sound ordinances with his gunfire, especially if it's after 10 p.m.
Also, I don't know whether or not he just double parked that van of his.
That is true. Have you ever seen license plates on the Batmobile? No.
Yeah,
no.
That can't be. It's a regulatory nightmare. All of a sudden, that's it. I'm no longer a fan of Batman. You did it.
So we have that. I mean, we're living in an interesting area where all of a sudden you could do some radical kind of science or experimentation. And if you were a person who, you know, had good intentions but nefarious capabilities, think what you could do. You know, a premise of The Dark Knight was the idea that Bruce Wayne, through Fox's help, has developed this network that allows them to basically spy on every cell phone in the entire city and see what people are up to and build this real-time imaging system, which if our government had, we would be very pissed about.
Yeah.
So, okay, so I guess, and man, I wish we had someone like Darren Kitchen of Hat 5 who probably knows all these laws, but it's like what the botnets did to find the vulnerability is the equivalent of going door to door, putting your hand on a doorknob and just twisting it to see whose doors are locked, right? Well,
no.
No. I mean, the botnet's job, not the installing of the botnet.
The reason
he made the large botnet was so he could scan the massive, massive number of total IPs, right, to see which ones were vulnerable. And then if it was – but then – so you get your hand on there, you twist the lock, and it's clearly unlocked. Now – I wonder what the rules are. It's like, look, man, if somebody has a piece of hardware attached to the internet and doesn't have it password protected, isn't that sort of like driving around and you just use someone's Wi-Fi that's not password protected? Is there an expectation to not? I mean, certainly you can't destruct their property, but if they leave it open, I mean, that's weird.
I think it's that kind of, if it's an open Wi-Fi network, I haven't heard anybody getting in trouble for using an open Wi-Fi network. I think once you start installing things on somebody's computer or something, you know, that it's different. Also, you know, it could be part of the nature too, is that, you know, your Wi-Fi network's basically done by a dumb box, you know?
And I know that for a while they were talking about making it illegal to leave your Wi-Fi open because someone could just drive up and use it to do bad stuff. And then they wouldn't be able to find that guy, which is stupid. I think that didn't go anywhere.
No.
That would be the most annoying ticket I think anybody's ever got is, you know, like somebody rolls up and all of a sudden you get in your email like, by the way, you've been fined $25 by the city of Oakland for leaving your Wi-Fi network open.
And then if it's anything like other tickets, then you get something from Time Warner saying, hey, man, we noticed that you got fined. So we're going to charge you a you got fined fee of $50 because we don't appreciate it. That reflects badly on us. And we have paperwork to do now.
Sucks to be you fee. So, I mean, I guess the question is, I mean, in this digital age where we have little to no nascent legal rights to our boundaries, you know, of our, you know, our own technical space and you know, how much right we have to somebody not just, like Brian said, opening our unlocked door and just noting that this is, in fact, unlocked.
Well, especially when that's the weird part. Like, yes, this guy did an illegal thing by setting up the botnet. We all agree that the botnet was probably across the line because thankfully he didn't use it to send spam or whatever. But instead, he set the botnets to do nothing but look for more vulnerabilities, you know?
So my curiosity is this. Is let's forget about the legal or the ethical ramifications. What would you do if you had 500,000 computers or... You know, what would you do if you said, you know what, if you could get away with it, what ambitious kind of research would you do? And I mean, you start thinking about things like, you know, you look at SETI, you know, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Do you want to maybe, you know, I just watched The Arrival last night, Charlie Sheen,
you know,
David Tui film. What's that?
I know you're about to go on to all the noble things we could do, and that probably should be what we talk about. But all of a sudden, I'm thinking about all the Reddits I could spam and all of the voting
all of the
I could gain.
People could subscribe to the Weird Things podcast.
Yes, exactly.
Sir, we could go in any direction, but I think that, you know, the criminal opportunities have been explored a lot, but let's start thinking, you know, the other things. Like, so a premise in The Arrival, the Charlie Sheen movie from 1996, where he plays a researcher who basically trying to find out extraterrestrial intelligence, he steals, you know, takes control of a bunch of backyard satellite and dishes to create his own very large array, which is kind of a neat idea and something semi sort of plausible. And then everything happens afterwards is completely realistic and totally could happen.
like Charlie Sheen being a researcher.
Exactly.
I buy all of it.
You accept that, we're in good shape. So anyhow, but it's kind of a cool kind of idea. So just, you know, reading this article and thinking about that, like, okay, what would you do? And, you know, you look at things like, you know, we have research projects where we try to do protein sequencing at home or protein folding at home. And take over computers and go do that. And
I guess that's the weird part about this question is it's kind of a reality because you sort of decide what clubhouse to donate your extra computer cycles to. What do you got? You got SETI at home. You got protein folding. I know of no others. What else is there? We should actually. I'm going to look that up right now.
That'd be good. Yeah, I'm sure there are other ones out there, but. Start thinking, what could you do with a mass amount of computers? If you wanted to go like full on vigilante and stuff, you know, you could start trying to, if you know, you could do, you know, denial of service attacks against people you don't like, which is something that happens already.
Here we go. On Wikipedia, the list of distributed computing projects, we've got ABC at home, which is find triples related to the ABC conjecture, one of the greatest open problems in mathematics. Do you know what the ABC conjecture is?
I heard it's a little bit better than A, B, D, E, F, 1.
Probably. Wow, it's some crazy theorem.
If it says factor, I'm just going to hear...
Yeah. Okay, so let's keep going. We got Albert at home, which is testing for Einstein at home. Ooh, how about background pi? Does that one seem a little bit useless to you? Computes decimal digits.
Oh, look,
pi?
Bitcoin. There's the one we just missed, was the idea of turning all these things into Bitcoin generators.
Oh, my God. You're so right, dude. That would be a lot.
How do you want to bet that's not already being done?
I'm sure. Yeah, that's, there's, I mean... Listen, and the Bitcoin story has become very, very big this week, but very interesting, especially as Bitcoin kind of got its first big taste of the main stage with the Cyprus stuff, where all of a sudden banks were not allowing people to take their money out, and Bitcoin's like, hey, look, isn't it interesting to have a completely unregulated monetary system?
It's largely controlled by criminal enterprise at this point.
It is. No, it certainly is. But, you know, it is a interesting an idea that I don't think I'm particularly comfortable with. But, you know, it was very, very interesting looking at that Cyprus thing and seeing, you know, the benefits that somebody who had Bitcoins had in that environment.
So we got climate models to predict climate change. We got cosmology at home to find the most accurate models that best describe the universe. Distributed data mining, that's kind of vague. Research in the various fields of data analysis and machine learning. I wonder if there's some kind of giant artificial intelligence product. Oh, here's a good one. Drug discovery at home. Design drugs, chemical compounds for medicines in cancer and neurodegenerative diseases.
So it's just like running models or whatever?
Yeah. Well, it's like, because there's just a lot of experimentation. It's like you got certain chemicals that you know in general do certain things, but there's so many different ways that you can combine them and set up their handedness to do different interactions. And obviously, you have to physically test them, but before you do that, you can pick out your best candidates by modeling everything.
You know, I think one of these is definitely Skynet in disguise.
Maybe Free HAL?
Without a doubt.
Free HAL, artificial intelligence?
But then I'm thinking, you know the way I'm going to hide my distributed Skynet project?
Huh.
It's going to be my kitten screensaver program. My free kitten screensaver program. And it's going to be all these adorable kittens that people are going to run on their computers and not realize that in the background of my AI growing, building, becoming more intelligent till it enslaves us all.
Man, there are a lot of these. This is fantastic. Yeah. Oh, look at this one. The M4 project decrypts Enigma messages from World War II.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
Just in time.
Yeah.
Well, so now, Andrew, I mean, like, I like the idea that you could use a botnet as like your own kind of vigil. I mean, you would really be on a global stage like a vigilante Death Star for like rogue governments or dictatorships.
Oh,
like you could just DDoS North Korea. I mean, for the five computers that are in North Korea.
Yeah. Look at this one, though. This is exactly what you're talking about. They got cryptography projects that are designed just to, it says combines Boink, whatever that is, with distributed.net to try to break the RC5 cipher. So its entire purpose is to try to, I assume, brute force some heavy duty encryption.
It's funny, too, when you think about what was proposed in the early 90s of what mandatory encryption system like Clipper Chip.
Yeah.
And how your phone could crack that now in like 5 minutes.
It's ridiculous. Well, that's the problem is you can't ever. The one thing, it's amazing to see the way legislation just forgets how everything continues to change.
Although I get kind of tired of every time I hear some sort of quantum project of how they have to justify for quantum cryptography. You know,
why is that?
Because it's like, all right, you know, I'm sure that's going to be an application for it. It's not going to be the application, and it's such kind of a pandering to, well, the business community is going to want this much more efficient way, you know, to do this. It's like,
yeah,
we're taking this very, very high end theoretical form of physics and trying to find a shoehorn against everybody. Oh, well, quantum cryptography. We can send a quantum encoded message to a traveling airplane now. It's like
we got. Orbit at home is monitor and study the hazards posed by near-Earth asteroids.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, here's one that I know we're all excited about. Prima Boinka. Search for counterexamples to Agrawal's conjecture and Popovich's conjecture, which relate to the identification of prime numbers. I think we've all been there.
Boy, it's only running on two computers, Agrawal's and Popovich's.
Yeah, the conjecture is that anyone will run their distributed network program. Radioactive at home, real-time radioactivity monitoring. See, this is interesting because a lot of these aren't for simulations to solve a puzzle. A lot of them are just to have, distributed real-time, tracking of something.
Yeah. So there are a lot of very interesting. Oh, there's a Russian Academy of Science wants some help with some crypto analysis.
Let's get on that.
Fantastic. Oh, the Beijing University wants some help in trying to decipher email codes. Why don't you sign up for that one?
Let's see. Study nanomagnetic molecules. Stardust at home scans, analyzes the collection grid. Sudoku. Determine whether unique solution Sudoku puzzles with only 16 clues exist.
Thank God, at last.
Oh, look at that. Here it is. The Skynet. Analysis of radio astronomy data from telescopes such as Australian Square Kilometer Array, Pathfinder, and the Square Kilometer Array.
Sure.
Certainly not that other Skynet.
This is a net about the sky.
So, we've talked about this before. Like, botnets are getting increasingly more intelligent. You look at the evolution of CAPTCHA and how, it's kind of like if you want to solve a hard intelligence problem, you just use it to protect a site or something, and you're going to find people who are going to engineer software to do that if they can make money selling you spam.
Right.
And, at some point, do we reach a point where a botnet or something evolves and we know there is this, it's kind of like a natural force where Skynet kind of becomes real. And, like, I'm already nervous about saying anything about certain forums or any kinds of groups online at the possibility of angering somebody and them trying to just say, let's take him down.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And we've seen firsthand how some of these places where if they decide it strikes their fancy, they'll go and do silly sort of pranks on people.
Man.
What happens when we realize or we suspect that there is this artificially intelligent botnet out there? Do we start monitoring what we say?
Oh, like for fear of angering? Like, you don't want to look so you got some kind of botnet that monitors for keywords, and we don't know what it is, but every so often it just strikes and it destroys someone's finances, plants news stories.
I, for one, welcome our new distributed omnipresent overlord.
Because you could create one that, like, if you wanted to really hound, let's say, a security researcher, which is such a nebulous term, but if you said, I'm going to make this thing that's going to go out there, even though you shut down my computers, it's going to go out there. Whenever this person pops up online, a Twitter handle or variant of this name, it's always going to go after them. And then it could comb through newspaper articles and look for other security researchers, et cetera, which could be kind of a cool plot, by the way.
Yeah.
The idea that you're so afraid of mentioning or putting yourself in context with somebody else that you will become a target of this.
I
think we should shut this down right now. Let's end this podcast and burn our computers.
Yeah, so that you can write this book and put it up immediately, because this sounds like a great idea. You totally should write this.
I'm more afraid of it than anything else, because I think it's bad enough when you have a human stalker.
Oh, yeah, but like a 24-hour...
Because you worry that there's no reasoning, right? That once, like, this is a dog, that once it clenches its jaws, you're dead. That it will just continue to keep going and become more ruthless, and there's no one to appeal to and no way to stop it.
Yeah, once it destroys, your ability to go online and have interactions, it'll go after your friends and everybody else.
Yeah, dude. I would be terrified of that, and in fact... If you're going to put Vegas odds on a rudimentary version of exactly that existing right now, what would you lay it at?
I don't think we've seen evidence that it exists right now.
You think somebody's writing something like that right now?
I think that you have the most resourceful people doing nefarious things, and resourceful, not the quote script kiddies to learn how to do a few things or dox somebody, whatever. The really resourceful ones are people with extensive computer engineering skills or backgrounds working for spammers, credit card frauds, and all these other things that make money, because that allows them to keep their enterprise going. And yeah. I think if one of these got targeted in such a way, you might see something like that. You know, we had the whole recent thing with Spam House and, you know, the whole, oh, the internet's under attack. Well, no, not really. But, you know, the idea that when people are doing something nefarious and somebody trying to stop them, if somebody has a lot of computing resources, they'll go after them.
I guess that's the question, is like, what would motivate someone to invest so much time and effort into that? Like, what could they be so pissed off about that they would want to? I guess politically you would have
Brian,
that.
Soccer.
Some men just want to watch the world burn.
I could imagine like politically or I could picture, you know, fundamentalists of one religious sect, whether it's a, you know, race supremacist or religious
noted coders.
Well, maybe it's the reverse. I'll tell you what, maybe it's the reverse. Maybe it's somebody who's just done with racists, and so he targets anyone who says, you know what, here's something I get behind. What if it's somebody who's tired of the N-word and the F-word being used in YouTube comments, and then just write something to utterly destroy anyone who does that?
I mean, I'll tell you, if we're picking terrorist groups to do it, I would see eco-terrorists before anything else, like of you know, some destructive, we've gone too far with technology and now we need to return to our pastoral roots.
Yeah, but I don't see the type of people who would be that savvy. You know, we're talking about, you know, kind of the Reddit level of digital savviness. Those people are going to be looking at the numbers and seeing how many ways things are getting better, though.
Have you met eco-terrorists?
No, not
things are getting better.
In that line, you know, you get your Ted Kaczynski's.
Yeah.
You know, and you read books by, you know, one of the founders of, let's say, Sun, talking about how we need to worry about computers taking over.
Well, I mean, that's legit, though. We do need to worry about computers taking over.
Yeah, but, you know, the methods to prevent it from happening are, what do you do?
Let me ask you this. What, this happens tomorrow. What level story is this? How do we process it as a populace? Is it like a bird flu story or like West Nile virus where it's like something, this is happening to some people? Is it like 9/11? You know, something that this is the new reality we have to get used to? Where, how do we contextualize it?
I think it's going to be something that people will, I think it's going to be more like global warming where it's like, there'll be a few people who are hysterical about it, and then other people who deny that it's happening at all, that it's a myth, that it can't be real.
I kind of think there's a story that would sort of build, because first you'll have somebody, let's say it's like a security researcher gets targeted, okay? And he gets targeted and targeted, and he keeps popping up, and he keeps trying to find the identity, and he's going to find this thing that's doing it to him, and he's going to track it down to some old lady's house and realize that there's script that's on there, get a little bit of this code, find out that what's going on is there's a piece of code that keeps being replicating it, you know, kind of, you know, like the kind of thing we use to destroy Russian centrifuges or something, and then realize that it has this algorithm where it adds targets to it or something. And the first thing is I think in the technical world it'll be interesting, the idea like, oh, is it, you know, it'll get overblown in the regular place as an artificial agent trying to stop this guy.
Right. Yeah,
because maybe they'll track the guy who did it, but like you can't stop it now.
So I guess, and that actually brings up another question, because the whole postulate of Skynet is man creates a thing that becomes self-aware and then just runs away and we can't keep up with it or whatever. But it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. It's like if we reach a savvy to create something like a Skynet, we will also be savvy enough to, at that level, have countermeasures to do it. It seems like you'd have to let Skynet go a long time before it became so smart and fast that you couldn't keep up with it anymore.
Remember, Brian, the idea is that it's gonna increase at an exponential rate.
Yeah, that's
so
the word.
It's gonna get smarter a lot faster than we do.
All right. I mean, I could see it infecting that many more computers. But getting that smarter, evolving progressively forward that much faster, just that, I mean, I know that's the postulate of it in the movie, but that doesn't seem.
No, that's the Kurzweil hypothesis, though.
Well, is that the processing speed will get faster, but knowledge and synthesis is not a function of how many parallel processors you have.
No,
you don't learn, like in order to get smarter, you have to learn, and you can't learn exponentially faster.
Why can't you?
Well, because stuff doesn't happen fast enough. You
experiments
don't
experiments do.
Well, I mean, it can run simulations, but then, I don't know. But it seems unlikely to me, I guess, would be the fairest thing for me to say.
I would like to feel like you do. Go ahead, Justin.
I'm closer to Andrew on this, and just because my general line on any technological advancement is that the smartest people we know are probably going to be wrong at how exactly this is going to happen. That you know, the trajectory that technology will take us, and you know, why it doesn't seem crazy to me that what we understand now as learning and the synthesis of knowledge is not a function that could be, you know, replicated at least synthetically, you know, by whatever technology we have coming forward. And that technology won't be like all other technology and ramp up far beyond the exponential level that we would guess.
One of the things we find, like, in trying to do, let's say, natural language processing, is that it's not so much you might need brute force to sort of figure out an algorithm, but the algorithms are often very, very simple. If you want to, like, parse out one word in a party of a bunch of people talking, it can be a very, very, very simple program to do that. And it's trying to figure out how to get at that. And you do, you know, as we know, evolutionary sort of processes to arrive at that. And when you can iterate these things faster and faster and improve your code base and do these faster, then you arrive at systems that learn faster.
So, here's the reason for that I'm so sanguine about it is that, did I use that word right? I'm using all these words. I don't know for sure if I'm the right. I'm very chill about it because, I mean, you read The Rational Optimist. It's like it is a recursive myth for universally among humans that there's a problem and it's going to get worse exponentially. And this time it's different because blank. And it just never turns out to be that way. Or so far, it's like those disasters for humanity, by and large, you know, on a global-wide humanity scale, they're batting zero, 100, well, zero, zero, zero.
I don't actually predict that a rapidly accelerated intelligence is necessarily a disaster for humanity. I'm in the group of, you know, the Ricardo, the economist, sort of the idea that if it understands economic theory at least as well as our brightest minds do right now, it understands comparative advantage. And the idea behind there is you 99.999% of all life on Earth gets along just fine.
Sure.
You know? And, you know, we have millions of microbes in our stomachs. We exist in these, you know, we're aware of these, you know, we're killing off animals. Well, actually, there hasn't been any, like, extinctions on continents in, like, a long time. But in any event, we'll probably get along very fine with it because we're going to have a symbiotic relationship in some way. So I don't worry about that.
Okay.
I don't worry. But.
Yes.
We'll go to commercial, then we'll come back with
your butt.
Yes. Well, again, area1851.com. Go ahead and help out with the Kickstarter.
Can I drop a little plug real quick? It's been several episodes since I've reminded folks that you know, weird things we do here, recorded on this computer here in this studio, which is made possible by our friends over at Doghouse Systems that gave us this computer that has worked out so well, made possible such a massive upgrade. We thank them, doghousesystems.com. And if you use promo code SHWOOD, then they'll know, that's SHWOOD. Not only will you get free $100 of loot from scamstuff.com, including a scam pack, but you'll get the free box art that's on this computer. And most importantly, you'll be letting them know that that it was a good investment to donate here to these Brian Brushwood studio.
What is that URL again, Brian?
Doghousesystems.com.
Awesome. That's absolutely, I mean, a great way if you enjoy what you're listening to.
And you're going to buy a computer anyway. Yeah. Well, it's like, and it's like they do really good systems. They're a boutique. They're not a giant mega company that's going to screw you over. When you call, you get one of the guys who are there. They're out of Dallas. They're good folks. They make really, really good systems. This one's overclocked and liquid cooled. Everything's super customizable. So if you're going to get a new desktop anyway, might as well get a badass one. Get it from our friends over at Doghouse.
Hell yeah.
Awesome. I want to do a little shout out too. We'll put a link up on our page for this. There's a big fan of an SFW show. He's a member of Diamond Club. His name's Andrew Epperson. And right now he's trying to raise money to buy a medical bed. because Andrew's got a condition that makes life a lot more difficult than, you know, it should be. And just being able to get out of bed and to move around is a challenge for him. And so he's got a funding project going up right now to help raise money to buy himself a new hospital bed. And if you guys can support that, that would be awesome. You want to go to the – we'll have a link up to the page.
Yeah,
he's trying to raise up $6,000. Right now, he's like $830 there. $5 helps. Literally, $5 helps. If you have $5 is to help a guy who, you know, is an active fan and basically is just trying to get something to make doing the things that most of us take for granted –
Yes. Well, and plus, and the guy's whip smart too. One of the things to, I forget which book it was. I was just reading. It was Sway. I was reading the book Sway recently, and it turns out that when you do donations, it's saying something like even what is it? They do experiments where they have people, you know, try to get money donated to the Salvation Army around Christmas or whatever, but they noticed that people perceive the problem as so big and their contribution so little that they decide not even to bother doing it. But they notice that when they say even just, you know, a dime would make a big difference. And then like giving permission, like you're not embarrassing yourself. You're not being cheap. This isn't a contest to look good to give just a dime. Like, seriously, I would like that dime. They noticed that they were able to get many, many more donations. So if you're worried that it's like, oh, this guy's giving $30, $50, $100, and there's so far to go, it's like, look, man, just give $1, give $5, whatever. It feels good.
It's gofundme.com/Andrew's bed, and you can read there about why he's raising it. And as Brian says, you know, it is just the fact that you go in there, and I think you can do, I think it's PayPal, I think you can do a dollar or whatever. You know, the fact that you do something even minimally like that, it helps him. It helps, it lets him know that you care. And it's one thing to say I care. It's one thing to say, hey, I hope you well or whatever. But another thing to make, you know, changing, you know, Jimmy Kimmel made a comment about, like, you know, when we change our avatars or whatever, it is the least we can literally do for something.
Yeah.
But going in here, making a, and I know, you know, money's tight for a lot of people, a buck or two, even a buck or two, it's a show of support. And it's saying, you know, instead of getting the fries at lunch, I want to help this guy's life be a little bit easier.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is a lot easier. I mean, if he's able to get this kind of equipment, and let's just say this, you know, we know the download numbers on this podcast. If everybody who's listening wound up chipping in a buck, that's a long way to his goal. So just, you know, I'll tell you what, if it's something that you're interested in, go ahead, gofundme.com/Andrew's bed. And thanks to Andrew Epperson for being a fan of this show and all the other stuff that we do, you know, get better, buddy, you know.
And what you're doing is a couple bucks. You are making a contribution to help the quality of life of somebody who, you know, when the lottery of nature dealt this guy, you know, a little bit of a bad hand, but he's handled it with wonderful spirit, just a great attitude, and doing just a little bit, a minimal, the same amount of money you know, to supersize or whatever. A couple bucks can help this guy, and you get to know that you are a person who's contributing and doing when you can things to help people who you have a lot in common with.
I'll tell you what, all we do every day on the internet is watch people fall down off scaffolding and get, you know, embarrass themselves on YouTube, just like these like moments in time that these people will never live down. The karma that you can do is do what the internet does at its kindest, which is find our community and take care of them. Andrew would certainly appreciate just a few contributions on his way to a far better life, because this bed would be a huge, huge improvement to his daily existence.
Right. Yes, yeah, and it's a special hospital bed that makes it easier to get up and out of.
Yes.
So. Yeah, it ain't just like a Sleep Number bed or one of those beds where you can set, like, you know, a wine glass and then jump up and down on the other side. It's not one of those.
No.
It's amazing. Hey, you guys want to do picks?
Let's do picks.
I can go first. I'm reading something right now.
Brian, why don't you go first?
So I did mention that I just finished the book Sway, which I enjoyed a lot. It's more about the psychology of – there are two books that I just read that are about, you know – how we are affected by outside forces that I don't want to say trick us, but guide us to certain outcomes. One is like 50 ways to get to yes. But from different contributors, including Robert Cialdini, who wrote Influence. And then I read Sway, which is a shorter book. I think it's only like 6 or 8 hours on audiobook. And it's a very good compilation of some of the greatest hit stories of the ways that we are affected. And I thought of both of those books as I read my actual pick, which is Inside Scientology, I'm reading right now. Which is the, Scientology, of course, is a hot button issue on the internet. You have a lot of horrific stories. You also have, counterattacks from Scientologists. This person is basically synthesizing, along with original interviews from people who haven't been able to speak, who don't want to be on the record, people who have been involved, but only just now as the statute of limitations run out on certain stories. She herself had involvement with the Church of Scientology. It is an amazing, compelling narrative where I find myself at times. It starts with the very beginning with L. Ron Hubbard. You go through his life and you find L. Ron Hubbard. You see him at times as an egomaniac. You see him at times as a lovable character telling tall tales. You see him at times as somebody who makes very reasonable assumptions about ways to move his movement forward. And you see somebody who passionately, at least seems to believe, the tenets of Scientology. So you find yourself, and then you see the handoff of different characters. You see the infighting. It is amazing because you find yourself at times very sympathetic to Scientology and other times utterly horrified. And it has been a lot of fun to read. I highly recommend it. I'm not quite finished with it yet, so don't tell me how it ends.
I've read it, and I was hesitant at first because I've read like about every book on that subject, and thought, all right, and I thought it was a really fresh, original approach towards it. A lot of original research, and it's very
readable.
I endorse Brian's recommendation.
It's well, good, because I didn't know if I'm glad you had read it, because I like the way it tells it all, just as a story. It's very it's a good narrative.
Yeah, very, very. I'll go now.
Go, Andrew. Go.
Fly free with your recommendations.
My recommendation, my pick, is do you ever find yourself kind of like flipping through Netflix, looking for something to see, and realize you spent more time trying to find something?
Yes.
It's too much trouble. It's paralyzing.
Yeah. And I used to have that problem at Blockbuster. I just walk down the aisles of Blockbuster over and over again. And now I can do that from the comfort of my own home, on the toilet seat, even if I was inclined. And I also do that with Amazon Prime. If you have Amazon Prime, they have a selection of free movies you can watch. The Amazon Prime library searching it is an absolute utter nightmare. It can be stilt-a-flying terrifying to try to find stuff in there because it's just the way that it's organized. But every now and then you find something. And I found something. I said, man, it's one of those movies I thought I'd watched recently. And I realized I don't think I'd seen this thing in its entirety in forever. And that was the classic War of the Worlds.
Oh, yeah. I watched it just like 4 or 5 years ago. And I was surprised at you're talking about the 1950s one, right?
Yes. Yeah. No, the Tom Cruise, the classic one. What is that?
Yeah, where they, man, that end scene where everybody's just in the church singing.
No spoilers.
But there is a scene where just it's clear everything's over and everyone's just in a church singing because like, well, the world's definitely ending and we're all definitely going to die. So let's just, think about that.
And I will say, of course, the criticism is that I would say that it is a movie that is very much of its period of time because, they did the, It changed a certain amount of, H.G. Wells had a very particular, let's say, view of science versus religion or whatever. And it kind of basically changed that a bit, but not as much as some of the critics would say that they did. I mean, if you listen to the end thing, then yeah, it does. But
I mean, wasn't it also at this time, because this is at the height of the Cold War. It's pretty much like the aliens or the Russians was the idea. It was the Red Dawn of 1950s.
And it kind of, yeah. But anyway, if you get past that, I thought it was it was an enjoyable film. Certainly a movie from 19, but thinking this is a movie that's 60 years old, and it's like being in 1953 watching a movie from 1893.
Yeah.
Which there weren't that many of.
I know that I had a similar experience when I finally watched Metropolis last year for the very first time. It was the first uncut. Like when the movie came out, they chopped it up so much. They chopped out like half of it, and then they lost all the originals. But apparently, they found a print in Argentina, very rare of the uncut thing, and so they put the whole thing together with period music.
They found something German in Argentina.
How curious!
Well, you know what's interesting about Metropolis is if you look at the career of Fritz Lang and the director of that, is here's a guy that was. And to a degree, kind of like Hitchcock, was at an early point of commercial cinema and then followed it through and continuously worked well into, I think he worked like 1960 or something when his last film was, into a point where the people making the movies we watch right now were experiencing not as, let me go back and watch this old film, but watching as a contemporary sort of productions by Fritz Lang. And yeah. So it has, and the language that he used very early on in Metropolis and other films is very much informed what we do now. And so it's some things feel very hokey, but certainly it's a sign of its times. But there was a technique and a craft there that you go, this is a guy that understands this medium, really understands this
medium. I mean, some of the visuals still pop. I mean, what is it? It's got to be coming up on 100 years old now. And it's like the visuals that sometimes are stunning. And what's funny is some of the iconic imagery that we know, but we don't know why we know it. And then you see it in, like, for example, there's this moment when he comes in and he sees these playful kids dancing around the pole with the ribbons or whatever. And I realize, like, oh, that's what they're referencing when in The Simpsons, when Homer, you know, has this fantasy of whatever. That's why you should watch all that stuff.
C-3PO.
Sounds legit.
C-3PO is right, yeah.
C-3PO is based on the robot. So, cool. So, yeah, War of the Worlds, 1953. And that was a George Pal production who basically, he was sort of the precursor towards the modern, you know, the Michael Bay movies were inspired by the stuff that he produced. So, for better or for worse.
Right on. So, what you got, Justin?
You want to know what? This is going to be a choice from you guys. I'm going to tell you Tim Robbins or Jake Gyllenhaal. Which of those two actors am I going to buy their reading of the unabridged F. Scott Fitzgerald classic, The Great Gatsby?
Oh, it's got to be Tim Robbins, I'd think, right?
I'd go Tim Robbins.
Yeah, I would think so, too. Gyllenhaal is going to be the newest one. But my pick is The Great Gatsby. You got the new movie coming out with Leonardo DiCaprio and Carrie, what's her name? Mulligan, I believe her name is. But I love the book. I don't know if I've talked about it on this podcast, but I have a huge anxiety that stems from when I was in school about reading physical books, like taking the time to sit down and read physical books. Because when I was in school, I would always be terrified that I should not read things that I would want to read for fun, because I should be reading other stuff that I was assigned to read that I didn't want to read. And so I would have a great anxiety about that. But one of the only books that I did read that I was assigned to read and I got all the way through and really enjoyed and has always stuck with me is The Great Gatsby. I'm very excited to see the new movie coming out. And I read it every couple of years or so. And this seems like a great time to listen to it on audiobook because I've never listened to an audiobook version of it. So I'm going to pick it up right now. And I highly suggest that everybody pick it up before the new movie comes out.
Right on.
You know, normally, I'm used to guys who've like only read one book, or like, oh, you know, a book's really good. Yeah, you know, one book I've only read. Justin's the most well-read guy that obsesses over a book like The Great Gatsby. It's quite interesting. I want to do a supercut when the movie comes out between that and Django Unchained, and make it where Gatsby actually, the scheme was Calvin Candy develops, or, you know, Gatsby either had a time machine and went back and made his money through slaving.
Yes.
Or Calvin Candy hops into the future and becomes the Great Gatsby and then goes back.
Number one, that is a supercut that absolutely needs to happen, is that, you know, Daisy is, you know, obsessed with, like, well, you know, he seems to be up to something shady. It's something a little bit more than bootlegging.
Oh, a little bit more.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, we get a really kind of weird sort of story with Dr. Schultz going into World War II. Telling you, it's going to be great. I think there's going to be, I think we are going to see the mask. There is going to be at some point sort of like, we'll get like a really cool super cut like that of something.
There's got to be a trailer. If there's, if there is not a trailer by the time that The Great Gatsby actually hits theaters, you know, I will be very upset. It's funny because I was watching the new trailer and, you know, the Buchanan, I forget his first name in the book. I think it's James. No, James Buchanan is a fan of this show. anyway, he's played the guy who plays him. I'm like, oh man, that guy, it kind of has a Tom Hardy sort of look to that guy. And then I find out that it's Joel Edgerton who played Tom Hardy's brother in Warrior. And I'm like, well, that's just as good. If Tom Hardy's not going to be in it, then his brother from Warrior, I'll go ahead. I'll take that.
There you go. Well, I think we're at a close here, everyone. We've had a little bit of interesting discussion here. We talked about the gates of hell, Unix, radio which, botnets. Which
we're clearly more terrified of Unix than the gates of hell.
Yeah, or Skynet. Yeah. Something like there's something there to the idea of finding out that, like, you know, Skynet involves as Unix. And we're like, Unix? Like, no, Unix. Oh, okay, we're okay with that. We're okay with
Unix.
That. Yes. It's made of Unix.
there is a great the Honest Film Trailers YouTube account that does like their like voiceovers, like, you know, making fun of movies and stuff like that. Just did theirs for the Jurassic Park 3D re-release and just like did like find out the cutting edge of 1996 and just highlighted like all the, you know, all the crappy interfaces and the little girl getting up to the terminal. It's like it's a Unix system. Yeah.
Amazing.
It's been weird.
Want to sponsor the podcast? Do you have $30? If so, go to weirdthings.com/sponsor and you can have Justin say whatever you want. He's a trained ape.